I'm Michael Cathcart on RN. You are so very, very welcome to Books and Arts. It's nice to be with you on podcast, radio, and on your phone. Today, once again, you and I venture beyond the vinyl frontier. Yes, those are just some of the weird sounds we'll encounter this morning when our ABC sound librarians James Lee and Michael Munson share some of the vinyl treasures that are in the ABC sound archives. Also today, Aussie author Stephen Carroll drops by to tell us about his new novel, Forever Young. But let's start today with the stories of four remarkable Australian women. Came to promoting modernism and modern art in Australia, women were right in the forefront. And we meet four of these women in a sparkling new book called Awakenings, Four Lives in Art. And what a lineup it is. There's Dora Olsen, who's a sculptor, Louise Dyer, who's the very famous, very great music publisher, Clarice Zander, who was a pioneer of PR, and Mary Cecil Allen, who was an art educator. The book is by Eileen Chanin and Stephen Miller, and we've got Stephen with us today. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Michael. It's a real pleasure to be on the show.
It's a total joy to have us. And congratulations on this book. It is a thing of beauty, the book itself, I mean.
Thank you. Thank you. The images are good, aren't they?
Oh, it's got lovely colour plates in the middle that really bring these four to life. And the wonderful thing is that you've really created these lives against the background of the rich, social story that you're telling as well. Let's very quickly just meet these four women. So in the shortest possible way, tell us about Dora Olsen.
Dora Olsen was, as you said, a sculptor who originally went overseas to train as a musician but had a career change and lived most of her life after a period in Russia in Italy from about 1902 until 48.
I'm fascinated by the Russia phase of it because she's moving in very lofty circles.
Absolutely, in the court of the Tsar. That period was very hard to research because it's still pretty much closed to English researchers.
So it's just so hard to understand how someone who was born in Ballarat could end up hanging out with the Tsar.
Yeah, that's the migrant story, isn't it, in Australia? She had a very ambitious and cultured father who really encouraged her to go out there and achieve, which she did.
Yeah, but when people say to you, you can live your dream, you don't really think that could mean I could end up having brekkie with the Tsar.
No, I suppose not.
And she created a war memorial for Mussolini.
She did. She was the only woman to create a war memorial for the First World War in Italy, and certainly the only foreigner. So that was one of her many firsts. Really a very successful sculptor in Europe at the time, but largely forgotten in Australia.
And there's also a story about an Anzac medal.
That's one of the many sad things to do with Aura. We believe that she was the first artist to do a commemorative work for the Anzacs in October 1916. Most of the other major works occurred in 17 and 18, but that's largely been forgotten as well. The story of it is fascinating. She did it to raise money for the troops, but because she had it cast in England and because she'd been living overseas for so long, when she shipped the medals back to Australia, the customs wanted her to pay duty on them. So there are 500 medals languished on the dock at customs, and the only ones that reached the country were smuggled into Sydney and Melbourne by Generals Monash and Birdswood, which is a great kind of image of these high-ranking generals coming back from London from peace talks, smuggling illegal medals in their suitcase.
How extraordinary. That's almost a movie right there.
It is.
General Monash and the scandal of the medal. Now, let's talk about Louise Hanson-Dyer because she's one of my favourite people, so it was lovely to read about her all over again. And she's the daughter of a very flamboyant man who I didn't know much about, Dr. L.L. Smith.
Yes, L.L. Smith that they wrote in the Herald with the pound signed as the L.L., which I love.
Yeah, pound, very, pound Smith.
Pound Smith, yeah. Quite a great character, you know, these kind of flamboyant characters that were thrown up by the gold rush and by the rush of money and the cosmopolitan nature of that became Melbourne in that period, and he really flourished and encouraged her. You know, he took her on the road campaigning for his zany political campaigns and going to New Zealand as part of these world expos. So from a very young age, she was in the limelight, and she was used to, you know, to public speaking and engaging and selling things.
And Stephen, living in very grand style. I mean, L.L. Smith is an entertainer on a really epic scale.
Absolutely. They were very wealthy at the top of Collins Street, wasn't it? The kind of wealthy area of Melbourne.
And
of course, she married a wealthy man as well, so was clever.
Yes, it was a smart move. My wife didn't make the same smart move, sadly. But it seems to work. So anyway, she goes off to Paris, and this is when she becomes really famous. She founds the famous Lyrebird Press that produces these exquisite editions of cutting-edge composers. Tell us about that time in her
absolutely.
Life.
Absolutely. Both cutting-edge and both early music, which went hand-in-hand in this period. She established a musical publishing firm, the Lyrebird Press, which did critical editions of works from manuscripts, but then also linked them to recorded versions of them. My first classical or Baroque recording as a kid was by this label of the Academy of St. Martin in the Field. So it's highly respected and still continues to be. And most people don't know that it was really the creation of a one-person team, this amazing creative and indomitable Australian woman. So she created it from the 30s, consolidated it all through the period up to the First World War, and then after the Second World War, it had a really very, very successful life.
Yes, so she basically runs these sort of salons in Melbourne, and then when she moves to Paris, she just does the same thing again. There's a lovely photograph of her in her Paris apartment in 1929, sitting in front of a very nice portrait of her painted by W.B. McInnes, who's an important Australian portrait painter, looking very grand and comfortable in a newfound role.
That's right. As a great patron, there's also a portrait of her by Max Ernst. So she was, you know, she moved in very creative and avant-garde circles as well, and as well as publishing Couperin and all those Baroque and Rococo composers, she was commissioning new work. So she was just as interested in new expression as she was in early music.
Reaching back, yeah. So Couperin is a composer she really puts back on the agenda.
Completely, yes.
Discovers him all over again. The thing I loved most about reading the book, Stephen, was the way in which you evoke the cultural scene, the times these people live in. And when you're writing about Louise Hanson Dyer, the sense of Melbourne as a place in which there is a kind of small L liberal tradition, a kind of openness to culture and ideas, progressive ways of living, that's very rich, and very beautifully evoked.
And, you know, it's something that they felt even more deeply when they went away, because, you know, they all found bigger waters overseas. But when they came back, they didn't kind of bag Australia as the 60s generation tended to do. They realised what opportunities they had been given, particularly in terms of education for women, and they were very grateful for it, because Louise found it very frustrating working in France. You couldn't have a bank account. You know, women didn't get the vote in France until the 40s. So when they went away, they realised what they had been given in Australia, and they were very grateful for that. And that's a common theme to each of their lives.
And she'd been to a famous Melbourne girls' school that was famous for its progressive ideas about the role of women.
Yes, but they all did. She went to PLC. Dora went to Sydney Girls High School. Clarice went to Oberwil. And Mary was educated privately within Melbourne University. So they were all given great opportunities in terms of their education. And their parents were ambitious for them and encouraged them really to do whatever they wanted to do and go out there and make a success of it.
Stephen, I often think that the role of wealthy women actually in feminism is understated, because a lot of these girls go to schools that are run by headmistresses who have, or in the case of PLC, a visionary headmaster, who have a very a visionary idea of what the role of women should be. And then when they get out into the real world and discover that they're supposed to behave like ladies and get married and just stay at home, they're just totally impatient with this. Mm-hmm. And it's that class of women who has a great influence on the way in which the feminist message is broadcast to the world.
Definitely. And it's those women that also created the infrastructure for the next generation. I mean, this was a big bit of the tale that we didn't realise until we started to write it, that they not only achieved for themselves, but they created opportunities for others to do it. They created networks through their patronage, through the way they nurtured young talent, which was in a way quite different to what the successful male artists of their generation did, who kind of the Streetons and Lamberts who came back as, you know, the great gods who had conquered London and Paris. Their achievement was much different. And we didn't want to push this line of the kind of nurturing women, you know, kind of going into the stereotype. But there is something in their stories that is about that, of creating opportunities for others and nurturing the talent of others, sometimes to the detriment of their own careers.
It goes to that sense in the 1920s and 30s among this class of people that they were building an Australian culture. So there is immense optimism in that period of the 20s and 30s that a new Australia can be invented, because these are people who can, you know, pretty much remember Federation. You know, the mm-hmm. nation has just come into being. So the sort of sense of despair and weariness and collapse that was so richly felt in Europe is not so keenly felt here in Australia, because there is this other, more optimistic, new world, new possibilities sense in the air.
Mm. And they were all very much daughters of Federation in this period. And their parents were involved. As you said, Smith, you know, he was elected to Parliament. Dora's father was building infrastructure. Mary's father was a founding professor of surgery at Melbourne University. So they were all very much involved in the project of not only building cultural life, but, you know, social and there was that, exactly as you say, that sense of optimism and excitement and opportunity to create something in Australia that was new and avoided some of the pitfalls of the old world.
Mm. On Books and Arts, you're with Michael Cathcart, and we're talking to Stephen Miller about the book he has co-written called Awakening, Four Lives in Art. So we've mentioned the sculptor Dora Olsen and well, the great patron of the arts and of music, the music publisher Louise Dyer, Louise Hanson Dyer. So Mary, you just referred to there, that's Mary Cecil Allen. Briefly, who's she?
She was a painter and the daughter of a very distinguished Melbourne surgeon. She escaped the kind of confines of her class and privilege in a way, and found a new life in the bohemia of New York in the 1920s. And she ended up remaining in the States for the rest of her life. She went through the conventional path of being a student at the National Gallery School and then being a convert to Max Meldrum, where all the young talented artists went, and then eventually went overseas and had a life for herself, both as a painter but also very much as a writer and an advocate for contemporary art.
And then we've got Clarice Zander, which is a brilliant name. Zander.
It's a brilliant name, yes.
who's a publicist. Now, that's an unusual role to have in this collection. Talk to me about Clarice.
Well, Clarice also trained as an artist, as they all did, but she became the first press officer for the Royal Academy. And in those days, doing that public relations work.
You mean the Royal Academy in London, you mean?
The Royal Academy in London, yes. Doing that public relations really meant writing articles for the press, giving interviews. So she acted as almost a curator and a press officer and an educator. Part of her story is she brought back to Australia in 1933 the first modernist exhibition of British art, which she showed in Melbourne and in Sydney, and artists that up until that time were not well known in Australia at all. She financed it herself and did it off her own bat. None of these women had any kind of institutional support.
And is it too much to claim, Stephen, that women were at the forefront of modernism in art in Australia? Because it's easy to think of other women who fit into that class. You've got well, Clarice Beckett and Margaret Preston and Grace Cossington Smith, all modernists.
Yes, I mean that's something now. That period is the period between the wars is a period now that we're really starting to understand and explore better, and particularly the role of women in as being advocates of modernism is you know better understood now than it was in the past.
And why do you think that is? This enthusiasm for the new.
It's ambiguous in all of their stories. It's very clear in Mary and Clarice, the two younger ones, the enthusiasm for the new. In Dora, it's less clear. She was deeply appreciative of the past, but she felt living in Italy, the weight of tradition. So the new was, you know, a way of breaking away from that and creating a new path for expression. So she had a very different relationship to it than the others did. Louise had a sense of the new, of being really not that new, you know, because she was so engaged with the past. She saw elements that contemporary artists liked, such as form and structure. She saw that in early music after the kind of, you know, lush melodies of the 19th century, going back to Baroque music and Renaissance music, it seemed very structural, very bold. And so the new for her was not that new. It was just a reemergence of something that had been there in the tradition. So their stories are, you know, their engagement with the new is complex, but it shows how diverse and complex modernity was.
And did they know each other?
They did. Louise and Dora were good friends. We believe that they were all in the same room at a lecture in Melbourne in 1912. So they were all together at one stage.
Now, what's your evidence for that? I love this kind of stuff.
Newspapers online, the best thing for researchers.
Oh,
these
yes.
Days.
What a joy. What a joy. Yes, when I think about the, you know, the historical research, when I first did historical research, you'd sit there with The Age or the Sydney Morning Herald for the, you know, a whole year and just leaf through it page
That's
by page.
Right. Or on microfiche, which was worse.
Yes, your eyes dropped out of your head. You thought you'd work for 5 hours and after an hour, you're going nuts.
That's
not only
right.
Because sometimes you're having to read it in negative.
That's right.
You know, white letters on a black background. Crazy. Yes, the fact that we can now Google anything with these great archives online is fantastic.
Makes a huge difference.
It certainly does. Well, congratulations, Stephen, on this book. I have so enjoyed reading it overnight. And as I say, the way in which you've evoked the times was very rich for me. I really loved reading it. And congratulations to you.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Miller there. The book is called Awakening, Four Lives in Art, and it's by Stephen and Eileen Channon as well. Wrote that with him. And it's published by Wakefield Press, and it contains lots of really lovely plates. There are black and white pictures and some colour plates as well. A very handsome book.